Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
You just power through it.
Right, know? Right.
Perfection's not an option.
Exactly. This is Political Breakdown from KQED in San Francisco. I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, when political campaigns, journalists, and pundits are looking for nonpartisan, smart, and insightful analysis about the campaigns and candidates in the United States, one source of information stands out: the Cook Political Report. It was started 40 years ago in 1984 by Charles Cook, known to all as Charlie, whose goal was to provide in-depth analysis of races for the hundreds of races for the House and Senate. The analysis is based on factors like voter registration data and trends, how voters in those states and districts tend to view political issues, and how the political climate helps or hurts a candidate. Charlie Cook joins us later in the show to discuss how analyzing political campaigns has changed. But first, KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati is here to talk about some political news breaking today: that Republicans in California are launching yet another recall attempt aimed at Governor Gavin Newsom. Hey, Guy.
Hey, Scott.
So, yeah, I've been talking to some Republican consultants this morning, and they're all kind of scratching their heads, wondering, like, what is going on? Why is this happening now? What is the point? You know, what do you think? I mean, is there some logic to this as far as you can see?
I mean, hard to see what the long-term strategy is here for this group. But I will say there is a difference in how the Newsom administration is responding. You heard his team come out right away and say they're taking this seriously before signatures are even, started to be gathered. That was not the case a few years ago, which, to be fair, look, most recall campaigns fizzle out before they're ever heard of. I just think the experience that Newsom and his team went through a few years ago are clearly informing how they want to try to get ahead of whatever potential recall attempts are to come.
Yeah, and when you look at the list of issues that they are laying out, these are some of the things that were voted on in the last recall, like he closed schools during COVID longer than other states. And then some things that really have nothing to do with him, which is that home prices are so expensive, that he's really undermining Prop 13, that old ballot measure from back in the 70s. So it's hard to see what even the rationale for the campaign would be. But it's also coming at a time when Newsom is raising his national profile. And I talked to Mike Madrid, who is a longtime Republican consultant up in Sacramento. And, he pointed out that this is really one of the reasons, this kind of thing is one of the reasons that Republicans have a hard time in California.
It's one thing to disagree with our politicians and the civil society. It's another to have this zero-sum politics consume us and make it impossible for us to get along and work together and seek compromise. This type of activity is precisely why there's no value in Democrats reaching out and talking to Republicans in the legislature to seek compromise, because this is what angers and stirs up and motivates the Republican base at this time in California history.
The point he's making, of course, is that, that this is just doesn't make a lot of sense. It's not going to win over voters. And in the end, it helps Gavin Newsom because it enables him to raise lots of money to fight the recall
right,
that he can spend on other things.
Right. And look, you mentioned the listed reasons. It's worth noting when that 2021 recall was first filed, it was before the pandemic. It ultimately became a recall about pandemic response. And I think a few things have to be said. First, even that campaign, which ultimately ended up getting routed on the ballot, it caught lightning in a bottle based on the fact, number one, that campaign was dead in the water before it got an extension by a judge to have more time to collect signatures because of COVID. And two, you had in a matter of weeks from that, the French Laundry incident, which really galvanized opposition to Newsom. It's hard to imagine those two kind of out-of-the-box factors coalescing. Again, that's not to say that, the discussion about recalls is going away. In fact, I think there's a chance California voters are, potentially voting this November on changes to the recall process. That's a discussion that started after the Newsom recall in 2021. And currently there's a proposal making its way through the legislature that would eliminate the successor election part of the recall process. So certainly I think the recall process in general is up for debate. You might hear more discussion about that moving towards November, even if this campaign fizzles out like many recall campaigns before it.
Yeah, and the other thing is that let's suppose they were to get some traction, catch lightning in a bottle, as you say, and they start collecting money. Well, at the same time, there are some races that, you know, Republicans really do care about in California, like defending some really up for grabs, toss up congressional seats like Mike Garcia in L.A., David Valadao in the Central Valley. And anytime you start diverting money away from things like that, ultimately, it's not really going to serve the party very well. But we'll see just how far along this actually gets. All right, we're going to take a short break, and when we return, veteran political analyst Charlie Cook joins me. You're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. We'll be right back.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today we're honored to have with us someone whose name is very familiar to those of us who follow politics carefully. His name is on one of the most widely quoted and appreciated publications, the Cook Political Report. Charles Cook founded it 40 years ago this year, and the Cook Report has become essential reading, really, for those of us who write or talk about elections and politics. And among the things it's best known for is its ratings of congressional races for both the Senate and the House, and the scale that goes from safe seats for one party or the other to likely, then leans, and ultimately toss-ups if either party seems to have an advantage or not have an advantage. And Cook stepped back from editing the publication a few years ago. It's now called the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter, who many of you, I'm sure, regularly see on the PBS NewsHour. But Charlie Cook is with us right now. And welcome to the Political Breakdown, Charlie. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Well, you founded the report in 1984, and that, of course, was the year that President Ronald Reagan was running against Democrat Walter Mondale with his running mate, Geraldine Ferraro. Was there anything special about that year that made you want to launch it then?
No, I'm up in Louisiana and had worked in a Senate campaign my senior year of high school and had been a debater and kind of got recruited to help in on the Senate race. And then and I'd worked in the Democratic side exclusively. And then about the early 80s, I found myself becoming a swing voter. And I wasn't becoming a Republican, but I was voting, splitting my ticket. In one office, I might vote for a Democrat, the next a Republican, or swinging back and forth. And, you know, it's in kind of poor taste to work for one party if you're not voting for them all the time. And you can't work, you know, you can't work for both sides. So I was trying to figure out how can I make a living in politics, but not work for either side. And there were a number of political newsletters out there, but none of them seemed to be aimed at people that ran political action committees, whether they were labor and environmental on one side or business on the other. So it's from the standpoint of someone who had worked in campaigns, been a pollster, and had actually helped run a political action committee and sort of tailored to what they were looking for. And I took my $6,000 out of the Senate retirement fund, and my late father-in-law co-signed a banknote for $10,000, and that's not how I recommend to start a business, but it survived.
It worked. Well, you know, nowadays, of course, things are so partisan. And, you know, even you ask people about the economy, and it depends on whether they're a Republican or a Democrat and who's in the White House. Back then, that was less true. Did that make it easier to start something that has become known as, you know, nonpartisan?
It was. I mean, it was just a completely different era. It was almost like being in a different country. And, you know, coming from one side, and what I did was went over to meet with some of the people at the Republican campaign committees. And, you know, I knew some of them already and said, look, this is what I'm going to do. But if I'm not playing it straight, I won't stay in business very long. And if you if you'll give me a chance, I'll show that I'm going to be playing it as straight down the middle as I possibly can. And you could do that then. I don't think you could now.
Well, I want to dig in a little bit on the ratings, because that is in some ways what the Cook Report is best known for, the ratings of all the, especially the House races, because there's so many of them. The spectrum goes from solidly in like a safe seat for a Republican or a Democrat all the way to a toss-up. And I'm wondering, like, what's the threshold for moving a race into a different category, and especially moving it into a toss-up?
Well, we're not purely quantitative, but it's not that we don't use numbers, but what we... what I had in mind is solid means, you know, it'd take an act of God for this side to lose, okay? And likely it's not a competitive race, but there's a plausible argument that it could get there. And then lean is competitive, lean Democrat, lean Republican. Those are competitive races where somebody has an advantage, but, you know, it wouldn't knock your socks off to see the other side win it. And then toss up is where neither party has a clear advantage. So the focus was on, you know, lean Democrat, lean Republican, toss ups in between the real competitive races. And it's people don't mind if you're wrong from time to time if they think you're playing it straight. You're being absolutely as objective as possible. And it's like there's not a team in Major League Baseball that doesn't have a statistician doing sabermetrics, but there's not one that's fired all the scouts either. And so they take a blending of both. And that's what we've tried to do.
Yeah. So I want to dig into one race in particular here in California. And we have four that are now in the toss-up category from the Cook Report. And they're all races where the incumbent is a Republican who defeated a Democrat in 2022. And these are all rematches, essentially. And I want to ask you about one of those, which is the 41st Congressional District. That's where Ken Calvert, the Republican, he's been there forever. I mean, for decades and decades. He defeated Will Rollins, the Democrat. This is a seat that's in Riverside County. It's a very long district. It goes from Corona in the west all the way through like to Rancho Mirage, Palm Springs. And so last time around, Will Rollins, who was a former federal prosecutor, ran that race. It was very competitive. He ended up losing by a few thousand votes. You know, it was certainly close-ish. And now it's a toss-up. So what makes the difference? What made you put that race in particular into a toss-up category?
Oh, first of all, the House ratings are all done by David Wasserman, our House editor, who is just a brilliant, brilliant guy. And what would typically happen in this case, it was close. The district has changed a lot. It went from a R plus six to R plus two. Now, what that means in English is that it used to vote 6 points more Republican than the country as a whole. And now it only votes 2 points more Republican than the country as a whole in presidential voting. And where we see the turnover, where districts flip over, it's generally R plus one, D plus one, R plus two, you know, D plus two or three. It's where it's close to that center point, that tipping point. And that one, that district has become that way. And, the amazing thing is to have four toss-ups in California, because we went for years and years and years where gerrymandering was so strong that there were basically no competitive districts in California for a long time. And so it's really kind of unusual to have this, but it's longevity incumbency doesn't mean what it used to. You've got a Democrat challenger with a good profile. Seems he can raise money. So it's going to be a very competitive race. And I don't know. Presumably Donald Trump will be at the top of the Republican ticket, and I'm not sure that he's going to be, you know, that much of an asset in a competitive California race.
Well, in a district like that, too, he could be a big motivator for Democrats to go out to vote, which would help, in that case, Will Rollins, the Democrat. You mentioned California didn't used to have all these competitive races. And of course, the big change here was when voters voted to create a citizens commission to draw these lines, take it out of the hands of the legislature. And basically, you know, as they say, instead of letting the politicians pick the voters pick the districts, in a sense. How big of a difference does that make? And we're not the only state that has done that. I think Michigan now does it, maybe Ohio and some others.
Yeah, Iowa is the purest example of where it's a group of statisticians go in a, you know, windowless room and told not to ignore where incumbents are and existing lines. And that's the purest. And California, it's kind of a Rube Goldberg, but it works. I mean, it's sort of very complicated in terms of how it gets, how these people get on to this commission, but it does seem to be a vast, vast, vast improvement. But there are other places that do it, maybe do it a little more straightforward, but it works.
When you say it works, it meaning what? You have a district that makes sense because of the different groups are kept together instead of being divided up and having their power diluted by the lines?
Well, what happens, I mean, generally speaking, if Republicans are in charge in a state, they basically draw districts that will maximize their benefits, and Democrats do the same thing. And as a result, 19 out of 20 members of Congress are in more danger of losing a primary than a general, because districts are either drawn to be very red or very blue, and there are very, very few purple swing districts anymore. And it's made the districts, as a whole, it doesn't reflect the country. It reflects sort of the two ends of the spectrum, and it makes it very, very difficult for governing.
Well, it doesn't even reflect the state, right? You may see a state that's pretty well split between Democrats and Republicans, but when you look at the legislative races, because of the lines that were drawn by one party, they're skewed way in favor of the party that drew the lines.
Exactly. There's a phrase, packing and cracking, where, you know, you're the dominant party, and one way of going about it is you pack in as many people in the opposition party as you can into a few number of districts, so that it makes all the adjacent areas very much strong for your side, or crack it up. Like, let's say you had a city that would normally vote Democrat, but by doing it pie shape with Republican suburbs around it, you can divide and conquer, if you will. And to Democrats, gerrymandering is something that Republicans do, and to Republicans, gerrymandering is something that Democrats do. And to be honest, when given the opportunity, that's how each side behaves. And it was only by the initiative process that California got it. I mean, it was over the dead bodies of a lot of politicians who were against it. But it was one of the few cases where citizens actually do prevail.
Yeah, and in that case, it was the governor who supported it, Arnold Schwarzenegger at the time.
Who was not really, functionally, was not in either party, and so he would be willing to do that.
Yeah. Well, he was also a rhino, you know, a Republican in name only, and I think he saw that people like him were being sort of primaried out of the Republican Party. But we don't want to go in too deeply into that. Do you have any sense? I mean, the sort of the conventional wisdom is that in a presidential year, the turnout goes up, and that tends to benefit Democrats because they have more occasional voters or first-time voters. Do you see that trend in 2024, or are there some other things happening like the war between Israel and Hamas that could scramble that conventional wisdom?
Well, that is certainly the way things used to work, but we've had a realignment over the last 30, 40, 50 years that may scramble that a little bit. That it used to be education, college-educated, graduate school, people with four-year college degrees or more turned out, voted at a much higher rate than more, you know, working class or poorer people, but that with a shifting of, you know, working class whites, and now starting to be a little working class African Americans, Latinos, moving away from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party, and upscale suburban college educated voters, more women, but not exclusively, moving from the Republican Party over into the Democratic Party, the education mix is different now than it used to be. And so that trend may not hold up in the future. And the other thing is, I think most of us assume that turnout's going to be way down compared to, 2020 and maybe below 2016. I mean, you've got two of the least popular political figures in the country likely to be facing off, and majority of Americans don't want either one of them. And so you could see, and a lot of these groups that had been pretty Democratic, younger voters, for example, African-Americans, there's a little bit of a demoralization there going on. And so their turnout could come down. So I think that this election will have a very different, the turnout will be lower compared to 2020. And just as 2018 was a record turnout for midterm election, 2022 is pretty good, wasn't a record, but it's pretty good. I think you're going to see it curl back downward in the lower turnout.
Interesting. Well, I want to ask you just a few questions about your bio. You do still have a bit of that Southern drawl, even though you're living in Maine. You grew up in Shreveport, I think, Louisiana, which is represented now by the speaker, Mike Johnson.
Yeah, it's funny. We went to the same high school. His parents were in my high school graduating class, and I've never met him.
I'm sure that could change if you wanted it to. What are the politics, you know, growing up there, you know, how did that influence the way you saw the world, and did that evolve?
It really wasn't the politics. I'd been a high school debater, and in debate, you know, 1 hour you debate the affirmative, you have a one issue topic for the entire year, and you're debating the affirmative side one hour, and next hour you might be doing the negative side. And you learn that if you're open-minded, you see that there are generally merits on both sides, and you appreciate that, you know, truth, justice, and the American way is not always exclusively on one side. And you see merits in various merits and arguments. And so I think the longer I was involved in politics, the more I began to see that there were a lot of grays, and that, you know, a seminal moment is when you meet someone in the opposition party who you totally disagree with, but they may be a nice person. And then you meet somebody in your party who you may agree with a lot, but is like a complete jerk. And it's kind of liberating to say, you know what, I'm not going to blindly go one way or the other.
But that's, and that really speaks to the power of personal touch, right? And whether you like somebody and whether you like a candidate personally, as opposed to you may not agree with them all the time.
Well, and that's why professionally what I've tried to do, and the people in this field that have done well, there are people that are able to successfully subordinate their own personal views. And you may think somebody is a horrific human being, but if it looks like they're going to win, well, they're going to win, you know, or somebody's fabulous but doesn't have a chance in the world of winning. And you learn, and whenever I start to have a partisan thought, I kind of just suppress it, because you don't want it to get in the way of your judgment. And I think now it's with the partisanship so much greater than it was back 40 years ago, it's more important and less common for people to be able to do that.
Yeah. You mentioned that you were a debater in high school. Did you grow up in a political family? Were your parents active in one party or the other, or just very political in general?
Neither one of them had ever worked in a campaign, volunteered, gone to order. I mean, no. I mean, my father was sort of had some interest in it, but it was not. I actually got recruited. I was using a law library, and someone at that law firm said, "Hey, how would you like to help out so and so?" And I did. But it was not. But if you're into debate, that leads itself to politics. And I'd already applied and gotten into Georgetown, so it was gone to debate camp a couple summers. So I'd already been bit a little bit by the political bug, but it wasn't ideological. I've always been fairly middle of the road.
Yeah. Before I let you go, looking ahead to this year, what are you looking for? And what, in particular, what might turn out not the way we expect it to?
Well, anyone who thinks they know exactly what's going to happen is delusional, or they haven't been involved very long. So there are always going to be surprises. But this year, there's almost like a codependency between former President Trump and President Biden, and that arguably Trump is probably the only Republican that Joe Biden could beat, and Biden is probably about the only Democrat that Trump could beat. And either side would be better off with a generic candidate that didn't have the baggage that these two guys bring in. And I say this as someone who's known President Biden for a long time, and I like him a great deal. But, age and all that, it's kind of gotten into the equation. And so that, when only a third of the people in your party want you to run again, then that usually is a sign of something. But, there's certainly plenty of legacy Republicans that aren't really excited about Donald Trump either. So this is it's going to be a very strange election. And the people that are going to be the deciders are the 8 to 10% that are the pure independents, don't lean either direction. And
maybe just like both of them.
Yeah, well, they don't like Donald Trump, but they don't hate him. And they're going to be voting for who they think will help them the most. I mean, to me, the fascinating thing about this election is it's the first one since 1892 that you had back-to-back presidents run against each other. So that basically invites a comparison side by side. Was I better off before January 20th, 2021, or am I better off now? And once you weed out the 9 out of 10 people that are partisans, pure independents, they tend to read, watch, listen to news less than anybody else, less than other people. They tend to be fickle. They tend to get buyer's remorse. And they're certainly not your listeners, that's for sure. Because the people that listen to you are people that care about politics.
And pay close attention, which means they are interested in the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Charlie Cook. I guess I should say happy birthday. You're 40. 40 years old. 40
well, I turned ago. 70 in November, so there you go. I'll take either one. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
All right. And that's a wrap for Monday, February 26th. Political Breakdown is a production of KQED. Our engineers are Jim Bennett and Seal Mahler. Our producer is Izzy Bloom. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.